Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, we catch a bat, but hopefully nothing more than that.
We've seen the bats, we've heard the bats, and now we're just waiting for them to go into the net.
Also on the show, climate talks resume, the Ukrainian wolfman, and Italy's dying breed of wild mussel divers.
Chatting on the beach with Sandro, Paolo, Massimo and another Sandro, it's obvious that these men have an enormous passion and respect for the sea and what lives in it.
Those stories and more coming up this week, so stick around. I'm Nathan Woodcock. Welcome to the show. Virologists here in Germany recently discovered that bats carry a far wider spectrum of viruses than previously assumed. Many like strains of mumps that can potentially cross to humans. Much like humans, bats frequently live in dense communities that make it easy for viruses to spread. So are we underestimating their role as a trigger for disease outbreaks among us? DW's Sonia Dean spoke to the researchers behind the study and went on her own bat capture to learn more.
It's around sundown, and I've come with some bat conservationists to the juncture of the Rhine and Sieg rivers near Bonn in Germany. The place is swarming with insects, which means it's a good hunting ground for bats. Martin Koch, a biologist, explains the plan.
We're going to stretch an extremely fine net over the Sieg in the hope of catching a female water bat. Once we've caught her, we'll find out where the nursery roost is to protect it.
So we've
just crossed over a small bridge. There are really a lot of insects here, and it feels quite warm and buggy, in fact. And it's getting ever darker. A lot of birds and trees in the area, and they are pulling out the nets in order to stretch them across the water.
Jens Strasburger is another biologist out here tonight.
That's the echolocation call of the bat. This ultrasound device renders the call 10 times slower than its original speed, so humans can hear it at all. Here's what it sounds like without being slowed.
Knistern, ja. Knistern. Genau.
As the last light is disappearing, we've seen the bats, we've heard the bats, and now we're just waiting for them to go into the net.
Not only conservationists are interested in bats. Here in Bonn University's Institute of Virology, they're preparing equipment for a test.
You set up a net and you wait for bats to fly in, and then you take them out of the nets, you keep them waiting for a few minutes to calm down, and then you take the bats out of the cloth bag in your hand, and you will find probably within the cloth bag or even within your hand a little bit of bat feces, and these are our main sample type for the study.
Okay, so you basically scared them into pooing.
Yes. Which doesn't take much.
Christian Drosten is the head of the institute and lead author on new research, suggesting that bats carry a wider spectrum of viruses than previously thought, including a strain of mumps nearly identical to the one that infects humans. But he doesn't see bats as a threat.
Whether bats are dangerous for humans? Well, I mean, there are some 2 or 3 documented cases of bat rabies across Europe within the last 10 years. If you think that's a danger, okay, then bats are dangerous to humans. This is a thing I can tell for sure, that we are dangerous to the bats because we take their resources.
Virologist Christian Drosten hopes people don't misunderstand his team's research to shoo bats away from their gardens or local parks.
Biodiversity really prevents pandemics. So the preservation of biodiversity and habitats, this will probably dilute pathogens in these ecosystems and, of course, prevent them from emerging and from switching hosts.
Back at the Zieg River with the biologist, we're in luck. Our nets have landed a catch.
It's got an elevated pulse. Water bats have big feet. And let's have a look. Female. Very good. Should be radio tagged.
Not only is it female, it's also pregnant. Jackpot for finding the nursery roost. Here's where the radio receiver comes into play. Trostberger gently affixes it to the back of the female water bat with some special skin glue that won't harm her. The device will fall off after a few days. After the glue dries, it's time to let her go. Sonja Dean, DW.
Ooh.
And we're going to stay in Bonn now, where a new round of climate talks opened this week. It's the first time negotiators have had a chance to reconvene since last year's meeting in Durban. There, the world agreed to start work on a new climate treaty that would bring all major carbon emitters under a legally binding deal to be agreed by 2015 and put into force by 2020. The task confronting negotiators remains as daunting as ever, as the UN's climate chief, Cristiana Figueres, spelled out at a press conference on Monday.
The very latest data that we have from Professor Joe Alcamo from UNEP tells us that the pledges that we have on the table would take us to anywhere between 2.5 and 5 degree increase, as opposed to the 2 degree maximum increase that governments have actually agreed to. So there is a gap there, anywhere between 6 and 11 gigatons. The good news in there is that UNEP assesses that filling the gap or bridging the gap is both technically attainable and economically feasible.
The UN's climate chief, Cristiana Figueres, there. Preparing for a warmer world already appears inevitable. DW's Irene Quayle has been talking to some of the experts involved in the challenge of adaptation.
Keith Alverson is head of climate change adaptation at the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, which has its headquarters in Nairobi. He says adaptation is one area of climate action where tangible progress can be made away from the negotiating table.
So my perspective is that adaptation is a low-hanging fruit, something we can make quick wins on as compared to the very great challenge of multilateral mitigation of climate change.
Adaptation, says Alverson, has to be tailored to take account of very local conditions.
Adaptation actions are not responding to global climate variables, they're responding to local ones. And adaptation actions have take account of local problems and local ecosystems and local societal vulnerabilities. When we adapt, we're usually adapting to something very local, say sea ice retreat in the Arctic or sea level rise in low-lying developing islands. And something that many people don't realize is the sea level rise is not a global signal. Off the west coast of the United States, sea level has been going down for the last 20 years.
Fatima Denton is climate coordinator with the International Development Research Center based in Dakar. Her program focuses on building research capacity in Africa to enable smallholder farmers to reduce their vulnerability to climate change. She says the alarming speed and severity of shifting weather patterns means farmers' traditional knowledge is no longer adequate. They need information tailored to their needs.
Farmers need to have very practical information about when to plant, how long would the grain season last for, what kind of cultivars and crops would do better in a drought condition, how do they address issues around soil fertility, what do they do about issues around soil salinization when coastal erosion is affecting the soils and the soils get saltier, so they're not able to produce or plant anything on those soils. What they want is a science that is giving them very practical solutions, you know, that is telling them what to expect.
Though these solutions cost money, the challenge isn't just financial. Peter Pau is a climate finance expert with the German Development Institute, DIE. He says some countries simply don't have the people or the know-how to take advantage of funds that are already available.
With the tryout that is happening now, the Fast Start Finance, you see that many developing countries do not even have the capacity to develop projects or to apply for this funding. So how can countries be helped? How can their capacity be built to develop projects, to get this funding in and to start adapting in their country? In the last decades, we've seen a tremendous rise in the number of NGOs in many developing countries. I think these NGOs have a major role in this. I think the private sector has a major role in this one as well. And the local and subnational governments should also help to allocate the funding for climate adaptation projects. But at the same time, I know that in many countries currently lack the capacity to absorb the climate finance that is actually coming to them.
Irene Quayle, DW.
Coming up, we'll hear why the divers for Italy's prized moscioli are themselves becoming a threatened species, and it's not for want of wild mussels. And we'll profile a Ukrainian man who likes to live among wolves. First, though, some news. Here's Sulfika Arbani.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has sacked her environment minister in the wake of her party's disastrous defeat in a state election. Norbert Röttgen had led the Christian Democrats' campaign for North Rhine-Westphalia. The Conservatives suffered their worst defeat there to date last weekend. Though others had stepped down under pressure, Röttgen is the first minister sacked by Merkel. DPA News reports that he refused an option to resign. He was formerly seen as a close ally of the Chancellor in his mandate to oversee Germany's energy transition. He is to be replaced by party whip Peter Altmaier. A British geoengineering experiment has been cancelled amid concerns of a conflict of interest. The project was to test the possibility of spraying particles into the stratosphere to reduce global warming. The aim is to mimic the cooling effects of volcanic eruptions. One of the scientists involved in the so-called SPICE project told Nature magazine that members of the team had not revealed a pre-existing patent application before the project was proposed. Geoengineering is controversial. Supporters say directly cooling the planet may prove to be temporarily necessary. Opponents say such schemes are dangerous and distract from efforts to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Japanese authorities say Mount Fuji may be sitting on a large fault that could cause it to partially collapse and threaten nearby communities. Following a three-year seismic survey, authorities revealed this week a new 30-kilometre fault that was likely to be active and could trigger a magnitude 7 earthquake. A magnitude 9 quake off Japan's east coast last year sparked the Fukushima nuclear emergency and killed over 19,000 people. And film actress Brigitte Bardot has offered to go to prison in place of a whaling activist arrested in Germany this week. Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society was detained in Frankfurt on Monday while en route to a meeting in France. Authorities were reacting to a Costa Rican warrant. The charges date back to a confrontation with a shark finning vessel in 2002. Bardot said she was outraged by the arrest and described herself as an accomplice to the incident.
That was Sulfika Arbani with the Eco News. And remember, you can find more of our environment content online at dw.de/environment. With over 7,000 kilometres of coastline, it's not surprising mussels are such a popular dish on Italian menus. While Mediterranean mussels are nowadays farmed in nets in the sea, the little bay of Porto Novo is a unique place where fishermen are still licensed to dive and hand-collect wild mussels. There they call them the moscioli, to distinguish them from the harvested variety. But the tradition of mussel diving is at risk of disappearing, and in this case, it's not because the supplies are running out, as Dani Mitzman discovered when she went to Porto Novo.
A boat trip across Porto Novo's bay to see the reef covered with gleaming black moscioli. Two research projects at Le Marche Zoological Institute and Polytechnic have recently confirmed what the local fishermen tell me.
La qualità organolettica, diciamo, che ne viene fuori è diverso.
They tell me they're tastier and more fragrant because they grow 5 to 12 metres underwater for up to a year and a half, so they get fatter on a richer diet than farmed mussels packed into nets. Paolo Angeloni is one of the small group of fishermen who go out every morning to collect them.
Cioè non sono trecce, una roba coltivata.
Maschioli aren't cultivated, they're natural. We take them off the reef. They remain just as Mother Nature creates them. We dive down with a little fork, like a small grappling iron, and a rope basket. We carefully detach them from the rock, but not at random. We choose the best and largest ones. We leave the small ones for the following year.
The fishermen dive up to 12 meters underwater using an oxygen mask attached to a long air tube and compressor on board. The boats are also fitted with a special contraption which washes the moscioli. It has a filter that allows any small ones inadvertently collected to drop back down into the sea and reattach themselves to the reef.
Lo scoglio dà al mosciolo il substrato.
The rock acts as a sort of life support. It's a sort of symbiosis, a natural exchange. The reef supports the moscioli, and the moscioli protects the reef from erosion.
Il mosciolo protegge lo scoglio dall'erosione.
Sandro Rocchetti is the head of the fishermen's cooperative in Porto Novo.
Noi qui abbiamo uno scoglio eccezionale, formidabile, che è lo scoglio.
We have an exceptional reef. We call Il Trave the beam. It's 1 kilometre long and about 10 metres wide. It's a natural reef which, for me, is a marvel of nature because it's pretty rare to have something straight across like this that's covered in mussels.
Il Trave. E il Trave fa da supporto ai mussels.
The fishermen's self-imposed limit to the amount of moscioli they harvest ensures supplies will never run dry. Their policy is to collect only enough to supply local restaurants and the community, in spite of requests from restaurants in big cities throughout Italy.
Come fa un po' le marettine, che trovi così di breccia, no? Di però la para. Te guarda, questa qui l'ho consumata.
Chatting on the beach with Sandro, Paolo, Massimo and another Sandro, it's obvious that these men have an enormous passion and respect for the sea and what lives in it. So what's the problem?
La pesca del mosciolo è difficile tant'è che si trovano oggi.
Fishing for moscioli is difficult, so difficult that there are very few fishermen who still do it. The regulations are very strict, the work is very hard. You have to get up very early at 4 or 5 a.m. and not many young people want to. So it's a type of fishing which is becoming extinct. It's becoming extinct because the new generations are more interested in discos than life at sea.
In fact, today there are only 3 operational boats and half a dozen mussel divers left in Porto Novo. Once a thriving cooperative with 40 members, they're now down to under 10. Many, like Sandro, are past retirement age, and almost none of their children have chosen to follow in their footsteps.
You need to be able to make a living, to earn a decent income. Today, unfortunately, moscioli are also in competition with cultivated mussels. They are abundantly available and tend to force the price of moscioli down, so it's a very delicate situation.
Quindi è una situazione un po' delicata.
When the slow food movement learnt about the fishermen's plight back in 2004, they added wild moscioli of Porto Novo to their list of Presidium foods to be protected. Head mussel diver Massimo Mengarelli says it's helped keep them afloat.
Slow food per noi è stato quasi fondamentale.
If we're still going strong, it's thanks to slow food. Before, we didn't really exist. They put the price of our moscaoli up and made our product famous. They gave us a high profile. If it hadn't been for slow food, I don't think we'd still be in business.
I think it's the only tradition, that the strong, the very tradition we have in Ancona. Mussels and Porto Novo.
Roberto Rubegni is the local slow food representative. He took me to visit a couple of Porto Novo's restaurants, which are all doing a roaring trade. Italians come from all over the country to sample the now famous moscioli.
What's your favourite way of eating it?
Yes, we call it fish and eat. When mussels are fish and eat in 5 minutes. When the fishermen come at the beach, the seaside, and they put them in a big pan, and after 3 minutes they are ready to eat with some lemon, or if you want, in a natural way. And they are the best way to taste the true flavor of mussels.
Apart from the lack of young fishermen, Moscioli are facing another problem. In recent years, large fishing vessels in the Adriatic have caused considerable erosion, and the biggest risk comes from clam fishers.
They create indisputable damage because they fish with pipes which blow air and lift a lot of mud. The mud deposits on the reef, which prevents the moscioli larvae from attaching. If they don't find a hard surface, they don't attach, so they die.
Massimo and Sandro believe there could be a way of protecting the bay which hasn't yet been tested.
A good idea might be to try to create some artificial substrata by throwing rocks into the sea. They would offer more places for the moscioli to attach, but could also stop the clam fishing boats from fishing in this zone.
But the biggest problem is still the lack of young fishermen to carry on the tradition. When I first met Sandro Stecconi exactly a year ago, he was adamant that moscioli diving should only be done by locals from their small community, but he's since had a change of heart. I asked him if he'd be happy if, say, an Aussie came along and wanted to join their cooperative.
Perché quelli da fuori no? Ben venga.
Let him come. He'd be welcome. I'm 72 years old now. Until last year, I was diving, and I'm going to try again this year, but we are getting old. We want people who will help us, who integrate, fit in, work with us, follow the rules. It's hard to find upstanding people with our passion. The sea needs people who love it, who fall in love with it.
So, who knows, perhaps it'll be outsiders looking for a complete change in lifestyle who end up saving the mussel diving tradition of the Adriatic's most picturesque little bay. Danny Mitzman, DW, Porto Novo.
Finally today, we profile Sergei Zhili, a Ukrainian ecologist who has lived with wolves, mimicking their behaviour, eating their food, and even raising 3 pups on his own. His views on hunting have put him at odds with other conservationists in the country, making him a lone wolf within the scientific community. Saroja Coelho has this report.
In a remote Ukrainian village, wildlife expert Sergei Zhili demonstrates a typical wolf howl. We sit in his home, a traditional hut on the edge of the Polesia Nature Reserve near the Belarusian border. Among the collection of family portraits is a black and white photo of Sergei holding the front paws of a huge wolf.
We were playing in the forest, rolling around, hugging each other. I hid behind a tree and attacked unexpectedly. You have to crouch and crawl to maintain size.
Sergei has lived and worked with wolves for more than 20 years. When he started out, he says he was unable to learn enough through books and watching at a distance.
I wanted to observe the relationships of wolf packs from the inside.
So in 1987, Sergei decided to rear 2 wolf pups on his own. He's a skilled woodsman, and he tracked a mother to her den, crept in and stole 2 newborns.
I took them. I had to sleep apart from my family. These little pups mewed and cried. I had to feed them with milk. The first 2 weeks were the hardest, when they were howling, waking up, desperate for the warmth of their mother.
The wolves came to trust Sergei. He ate with them, slept with them, observed them as they learned about the world. But he says he failed to recreate the strict hierarchies central to wolf packs.
My first experience back then was not very successful. I was too lenient. My wolf would growl at me, treat me as its equal, not its leader. I would step aside, encouraging aggressive behavior. It was also a mistake to take the baby after its eyes were open and it had bonded with its real mother. That happens in the first 3 days, and I was a little late. So these wolves were very hard to tame.
But the experiment made Sergei one of the country's most knowledgeable wolf experts. His book, Brother Wolf, I'm Not Your Mother, is popular with lay people and experts alike. In 2000, Sergei tried again. This time he took just one pup before its eyes were open. Sergei mimicked the role of an alpha male. Alphas have the greatest amount of social freedom within a wolf pack.
As the wolf grew, he started to play. These games imitate adult behavior. You have to hide away and attack. These games are connected with establishing hierarchy. In wolf pack, this is called linear hierarchy.
Sergei had to eat first, enforce his decisions, even enact punishment.
We had bash-ups with each other, physical combat. When you are trying to attack a wolf, his first response is, "Don't approach me." His face wrinkles, he bares his teeth. Then he pounces on you, and you have to be really resistant and push back. Otherwise, he will knock you down. A wolf wants to take grip of most vulnerable parts of the body, the neck or between your legs. Once you push the wolf off, you have to attack. Lie down on him. His back has to be on the ground, belly exposed, in a pose of defeat.
Once we're in the woods, he shows me where wolf tracks intersect with the prints of moose, deer, and lynx. He says that with a near unlimited meat supply, Polesia's wolf packs are rapidly multiplying. After this year's procreation period, he says Ukraine will be home to 7,000 wolves, double the number from last year.
There are changes taking place. The population is increasing immensely. And any expert can tell you that it isn't good to have any extremes, extinction or overpopulation.
He's concerned that rapid growth will lead the animals to ravage moose and other game populations and leave them without anything to eat.
Simply put, the wolf will have no food. If we look at the West, to Poland and Scandinavian countries, hunts are well organized. We need to create a national plan to maintain normal population levels. Soon, nature will take care of the problem, but this isn't what I want. From a humanist standpoint, it's not a good thing when animals starve to death.
But Sergei's views on culling have put him at odds with other ecologists in Ukraine. Ukraine is poor and international funding is almost non-existent. Wolf protection initiatives attract international funding, and Sergei says that makes some scientists exaggerate the threat to the wolf population. But he's forging ahead with his own work in his isolated northern village. He's already planning his next close encounter.
I don't think I will repeat my experience with a male pup. I would like to try what the Magi outcasts once did, to live with a female wolf, be taken in as a pup who she cares for and brings food.
Seroja Kuelo, DW, Polesia Reserve, Ukraine.
And you can hear more from Seroja next month when she'll be stepping into my shoes here on the show. If you didn't catch the news last week, I'll be moving on from Living Planet come June. Still, two more shows before then. But that's all for this week. Thanks for listening. If you want to leave feedback, the email address is livingplanet@dw.de. Till next week, I'm Nathan Witkop. Bye for now.